You're listening to Understanding Disordered Eating with Rachel Heineman, and today is episode 126. Now, before I get into what we're talking about today and who we're talking to, if you are a clinician and you haven't yet downloaded your copy of the one-hour training about the basics of assessment of eating disorders, I'm really not sure what you're waiting for. This is going to be so, so important if you're learning how to treat eating disorders, or if you don't, quote, specialize in eating disorders, because somebody with disordered eating or eating disorders is already around you, is already seeing you for whatever services you provide. And if you learn how to detect it early, you become the person who allows this person to buy back so many years that they wouldn't otherwise have if you didn't detect it early. So you can scroll down to the show notes or head onto the website and purchase it there. Today's episode, I'm really, really excited about. We're talking about lying and deception, which is so fascinating. And we're talking with Tom Wooldridge. So you'll remember Tom from episode, I believe it is 64. And we talk about when words fail and bodies speak, which was a really fascinating conversation. And in my mind, ultimately the crux of when we get at what is the deeper meaning behind someone's eating disorder or relationship with food. That is the episode to listen to. He is a psychologist and a certified eating disorder specialist and consultant, and is the chair of the Department of Psychology at Golden Gate University. He's a psychoanalyst, so naturally one of my favorite clinicians. He's written or edited a couple of books, been interviewed in tons of different places. He's on the Scientific Advisory Council of National Eating Disorder Association, faculty at the Psychoanalytic Institute of Northern California and the Northern California Society for Psychoanalytic Psychology, an assistant clinical professor at UCSC's Medical School, and has a private practice in Berkeley, California. Tom is an expert in the field of eating disorders and understanding the deeper meaning of what the eating disorders symbolize. Today, we're talking about lying and deception. And I think that the first thing that comes to a lot of people's minds when we think about this topic in relation to eating disorders is that a lot of people, especially someone with, quote, more severe eating disorder, might turn to lying in order to hide and protect their eating disorder behaviors from their team or their loved ones in order to just be able to do their eating disorder. And we see that as almost like a function of or a product of the disease. Now, the way that we talk about it today is, what potentially is the function of the actual lying? What might be protective? What might be going on interpersonally that might lead this person to any form of lying and deception? We talk about the nuances of it all, like, is all lying bad? How does it impact relationships? How does it impact treatment? And of course, what you can actually do about it. All right, here is my conversation with Tom. All right, Tom, I'm so excited to do this again. This is a treat for me. Thank you for coming back to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So today we're talking about something really exciting and juicy, which is lying and manipulation, things under that umbrella. And I think as practitioners, we so often lump it with eating disorders when in and of itself is a really complicated idea. You know, why do people lie? What's protective about lying? How do we understand someone's relationship with the truth in a much more complex way, as opposed to just saying like, well, that's someone's eating disorder. So maybe we can start off with a little bit more of like, why would a person lie?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to jump into the topic. Thank you. I got interested in this as a question because I, like I'm sure many clinicians, you know, have had patients that I've come to find out as treatment unfolds, you know, we're saying things that turned out to not be true. Often with eating disorders that can center around, weight and eating practices. There's been various articles about clinicians working with patients who were reporting, you know, that they were eating well when in fact they weren't, or that their weight had, you know, gone up when in fact it hadn't. So it's not just, of course, patients with eating disorders. In fact, I think we all lie. We lie to ourselves, we lie to other people, and we lie for different reasons. And so when we're thinking about this question psychoanalytically, the last thing we want to do is to adopt a kind of moralistic stance. We're not so concerned with, you know, lying is bad, truth is good, and any kind of top-down judgmental way. We're wanting to think about what is the internal life of this person and how do we understand their deception in light of our understanding of their internal life.
Yeah. So just sort of piggybacking off of what you're saying, a lot of the way that I think about anything that maybe might be labeled as pathological, which is, again, like a judgmental term, not my favorite, but I like to think about things as potentially protective, especially as we think about someone's developmental history. And I wonder if you can speak to that. Like, how might someone not telling the truth to somebody else be protective?
Mm-hmm. So I, you know, in the article that I wrote about deception, I adopted this framework from a psychoanalyst named Alessandra Lemma, who has a, I think, a lovely article about lying. I think it was in the International Journal of Psychoanalysis. And she looks at the internal object world of people that are, you know, deceptive. And what I mean by the internal object world, maybe I should just define that. So, you know, in this way of thinking, it's called a kind of object relations way of thinking. We all grow up and we internalize our experiences with other people, you know, and when we're very young, maybe with parts of other people. And as we grow up, then, you know, with actual other people, we develop this system of internal representations of them. And that system, that object world, it shapes our contemporary experiences. It highlights certain aspects of our experience. So, you know, just to really, really simplify things, if I had a mother that was intrusive and controlling, I might be more likely to experience somebody in my life today in that way. The features of their behavior that are intrusive and controlling will be the ones that are the most salient to me. Mm-hmm. And in the psychoanalytic situation, patients come into our offices and they very quickly, if things are going well, develop a transference where that internal object world really comes to life with us. So that's the kind of backdrop for thinking about the different kinds of deception. So then Alessandra Lemma, she distinguishes between two broad categories of lying, and those are sadistic lying and self-preservative lying. And then there's different types of self-preservative lying, but just to stay with the two broad categories for a minute, sadistic and self-preservative, it's that latter category, self-preservative, that would be more about self-protection. And of course, people may not fall neatly into one category or the other. Of course, they can have both motives. It may be that one or the other is more salient at a given moment in a treatment.
I'm way more interested in the sadistic lying. What's that?
Yeah. Well, I think sadistic lying, you know, is kind of what we'd imagine it is. It's a violent and deliberate, assault on another person. It's really an attempt to turn the tables. We in some way have felt disrespected or humiliated, and we lie to reverse that power dynamic. You know, I'm no longer the small, helpless, humiliated subject. I turn the tables, and now you're the one that's had the wool pulled over your eyes. And so the anxiety that motivates it, I think, is an anxiety about, you know, shame and humiliation and an experience of the self as unable to tolerate that.
Yeah. Well, so then even this person who might be more sadistic in their lying seems to come from a place of self-preservation. You know, I no longer want to, or I can't tolerate being in that position. That's so painful for me to be the little person, the victim here. And so I'm going to turn these tables and ultimately protect myself from ever being close to that experience. So in a way, I guess if you turn it on its head, then they're sort of interchangeable.
In a way, I mean, I think that in sadistic lying, there is an anxiety, and that anxiety reflects an internal vulnerability. Of course, that vulnerability is likely disavowed, so it's not consciously experienced. What is experienced is the wish to kind of pull one over or, you know, pull the wool over the eyes of the other person. So, you know, it's certainly not that there's no vulnerability in the liar, in the actor that is lying, but it's not a prominent conscious experience for them. Mm-hmm.
So maybe the difference is how aware the person is of what they're doing and why they're doing it, as opposed to somebody who might lie just to sort of get out of something immediately. Like, I don't know what to say. I don't want to be hurt. I'm just going to tell a lie.
It could be. It could be that, you know, there are different degrees of conscious awareness. I mean, I do take your point. I think there is something about sadistic, even about sadistic lying that is, you know, self-protective. I guess if we take sadistic lying to its extreme, we'd end up with something like, you know, psychopathy or malignant narcissism. So you'd have mm-hmm. a person that, you know, whatever vulnerability is kind of deep in there is pretty inaccessible.
Right. Well, I think that's the issue that, I mean, I'm sure you come across, as I certainly do, when trying to understand the person who's sitting in front of me. There's a certain level of how distant is this person from all the psychodynamics underneath? Like, how much can we pull from why they're doing what they're doing and bring that into the person's awareness? Or how far deep is it? In which case, it's not really that appropriate to try to bring that forward. It's more so like, let's deal with what we're actually seeing. There's always a reason for why people are doing what they're doing. Like, you know, someone who's an extreme narcissist or a psychopath or something, like, obviously there's a reason when we're thinking about it psychoanalytically. But yeah, I guess then the next question is, so what do you do about it? Probably something very different from somebody who has a moment of narcissistic injury. Would, you know, we would just approach it very, very differently.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the way I would put it is that in any moment of interaction between therapist and patient, there's always, some people have called it like a workable surface. There's a surface mm-hmm. that is accessible in the transference. And
yeah.
That varies depending on the patient and moment to moment with each patient. So, you know, there mm-hmm. are people that are so defended or encapsulated that the underlying, you know, humiliation or shame or vulnerability is really inaccessible most of the time or all of the time. But for mm-hmm. many of our patients, for all of us, really, you know, we can have a moment of, you know, sadism, whether it's a kind of internal fantasy or something that we act out through a kind of deception, but that it's not our only state of mind. You know, we can be in that sadistic orientation for a moment or a minute or an hour or even a day, but there are other states that are available and accessible.
Right. So let's just clarify for the majority of us that. That's where we lie. We're not suggesting that people who lie are sadists, not by any stretch of the imagination. But something that you're saying, I think, sort of brings me back to this age-old conversation debate of what's your school of thought? How do you approach eating disorders? How do you treat them? Are you behavioral? Are you more dynamic? And I think this crossroads is sort of where I try to shy away from that conversation completely, because I think a lot of the decisions about what we do, about what's in front of us, is based on what's in front of us. And so thinking about somebody whose dynamics or the reasons why they're doing what they're doing is so far buried, then it wouldn't even be the point to try to understand why. The point is, well, let's try to target your eating disorder, get you not symptomatic. And then that person, for that specific set of behaviors, it might never be in the cards for them to understand why. And somebody who's more in and out of these states, who might be able to understand a little bit more, might be closer to their consciousness, then yeah, we would do a little bit more exploratory work. But I think for somebody who's really entrenched in their symptoms and it's too far away from their conscious awareness, then this conversation would be completely intellectual for the person who's treating them. To try to understand. You wouldn't actually take this conversation to the therapy, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think again it's that question of what are a person's capacities in a given moment, what's the surface that presents itself in treatment, mm-hmm. and what's most salient to their goals. So, you know,
right.
I think it's never going to be the case that a kind of intellectualized conversation about, you know, deception is going to be particularly helpful to a patient. It's much more about, you know, getting a read of where they are in a given moment.
Right. Because let's say we're having a conversation and I think you're lying to me. If I say, Tom, you're lying to me. Conversation over.
Well, it would depend, wouldn't it? I mean, I think, you know, people at different moments and people in general, they have different capacities. So I could imagine, you know, certain, say, a friend, you know, who's telling you a white lie, say, and you say, "Are you sure about that?" And they say, "Oh, you know, you're right. That's not really true. Actually, whatever, this is true." They'd have the ego strength, they'd have the self-esteem to be able to tolerate that minor confrontation and make use of it. Whereas another person might feel, you know, very thin-skinned and humiliated by such a confrontation, and they'd withdraw. So it's really about the character of the person that you're with and the state they're in a given moment.
Right. Probably also the relationship that you have and the thing that they're lying about. Because I'm thinking So I'm thinking about specifically with eating disorders, like you're saying, so many people tend to lie about what they're eating, what they're not eating, and maybe with weights, like they might be lying about that. I guess I'm curious, like, let's talk a little bit more about the connection with eating disorders and lying and deception, and maybe, because maybe I think it'll be helpful to merge the two a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we should talk about the other form of lying, the self-preservative lying, which, you know, in my thinking is often more relevant to patients with eating disorders. So, you know, again, eating disorders are a heterogeneous group of conditions. So, you know, there are many different eating disorders, and even with the same eating disorder, let's say anorexia, I don't assume that the character structure, that the personality structure in the person in front of me is the same as every other person I've seen with anorexia. People come in with, you know, very different meanings that have accrued around their symptoms. So, you know, with each patient, we have to be, again, sort of revising and refining our case formulation as we go along. But there are some general ideas that I think that can help us to orient towards particular kinds of patients. And one idea that's been useful to me is Gianna Williams' idea of the no entry defense. So Gianna Williams has this idea that, at least for some people with eating disorders, they've had an experience of being used as a kind of receptacle for parental projections. So you have a parent who's, you know, him or herself, very, very anxious and kind of overflowing with anxiety. And they use the child in some way to contain, not in a good sense, but as a kind of receptacle for their anxieties. So, you know, in the paper I wrote, I gave an example of a young woman I saw for a long time who's, you know, was in a nuclear family, and her father would stay out late or not come home. Turned out later he was having an extramarital affair. And the mother would become increasingly distressed each night as the night went on. And she would start out, you know, coming to her daughter for comfort, for support, which is already a difficult situation for a child, right? When there's a kind of reversal of the parental function. You've got the child soothing the parent instead of the parent soothing the child. Mm-hmm. But as the night went on, it would start to reverse. And the mother, you know, what was a request for comfort would turn into more of a kind of accusation that the child was distant, was cold, was cruel. This is a kind of, you know, borderline level of functioning in a parent where they've, you know, gotten confused about the child and the husband who's out having the affairs. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the patient, she'd experienced this as a kind of putting into her, you know, almost like as a foreign object, putting into her of the mother's anxieties. It's an experience of, you know, really profound intrusion. So, you know, that's an example of the no entry system of defense. Because of that, we call it a kind of cumulative trauma. She developed a characterological style that had a lot to do with keeping things out, keeping things at a distance. And lying, you know, for her turned out to be one manifestation of that underlying characterological style.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you gave this example. It doesn't exactly fit, but it sort of makes me think of interpersonal and relational dynamics that would lead someone, or at least is connected to someone's desire or urge to lie. And a lot of what I think about is the level of trust that a person has in another person. Because if I'm lying to you, I don't trust you with the truth. I need to, you know, protect myself by not sharing all the truth. And if I fully trusted you, then I would have no reason to lie. So in an example like what you just said, this figure who was supposed to be the protector And the safe person was actually the person who was being most intrusive and at times really harmful. And so, I mean, for sure, no trust, but also in this self-preservative sort of way, I need to keep you out. And so I think going back to this idea of how is lying protective potentially, and thinking about it in terms of navigating relationships, that this person is trying to protect themselves from people who might hurt them.
Yeah, yeah, I think that that's exactly right. I mean, with this patient as an example, you know, in the transference, there was a real fear that I would turn out to be like her mother. And, you know, because of that, the intensity of that transference, small things that I did, you know, say a worried look on my face, would very much feel to her like, you know, a version of what her mother did to her. You know, I'm mm-hmm. putting my worry into her, burdening her with my worry, imagining her to be, you know, the kind of bad child that causes me pain and suffering. And so, you know, the deception was often an attempt to create a boundary between me and her, to kind of give some space between me and her. It was an effort mm-hmm. to kind of evade that experience of me being like her mother. And so, you know, that for her was the self-protective element. It was about evading a certain kind of emotional experience that was really hard to tolerate.
Yeah. So obviously each person is going to be different based on the specific relationship, the specific lie, the specific context. And I think it's really useful to try to understand where it comes from. So why does a person lie? But when it comes down to an actual relationship, and you and I are therapists, so we're sitting across from our clients or patients and trying to deal with somebody who might not be sharing the truth and sort of getting to what might be underneath it. But in practical terms, how does one go about that? Like, it's nice to intellectualize, oh, this person's coming from a protective place. But like, in the moment, it's not usually how that plays out very often.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I think this is where psychoanalytic theory and a really solid case formulation can be, you know, just so essential. You know, one path that one might take, you know, I think it's the path to take in our day-to-day lives is, you know, we could just confront the other person. We could say, you know, hey, I know what you're saying is not true. You know, you're lying to me. What you're saying is X. What's true is Y. What's going on? And, you know, I don't rule out that that could never be productive. But, you know, for most patients, most of the time, they're lying for reasons. And if we, you know, proceed with a kind of direct confrontation, especially right out of the gate, their anxiety, whatever anxiety it is, will intensify. Their defenses will consolidate and harden, and they'll actually become more accessible, not less. Maybe they won't even stay in the treatment. So, mm-hmm. you know, I just start by saying that kind of more direct approach is usually not the right way to go. I think, so where does that leave us? Well, I think we start to think about, you know, like with the case I started to describe, you know, okay, I have a sense that maybe I'm being lied to. How am I understanding that here? And you know, in this case, the way I understood the lying over time, you know, over many, many, many weeks, is that it had something to do with the patient's experience of me as being like her mother, as being intrusive, as being, you know, invasive, burdensome in various ways, and maybe, you know, about a worry that I would think of her as being bad in the way that her mother thought of her as being bad. So instead of confronting the lying directly, can I start, you know, very, very slowly to speak to that transference as I understand it? Can I start to articulate, to help the patient to symbolize, to put into words their experience of me and the likeness of that experience to her experience of her mother? And is something about putting all that into words able to make the anxiety more workable, more tolerable?
So, you know, are you suggesting to a certain extent that you don't address the lying at all sometimes? It's more so talking about the transference, the relationship in general, and then getting this person to a more comfortable place with you?
I think it's very rare that I'd be, you know, able to say, always do this, always do that. You know, there are no hard and fast rules. But I think most of the time I would hope to get to a place where we could speak about the deception, but but usually only after quite a bit of groundwork has been laid, you know, usually only after I have a sense that it's at the workable surface, that it's something we can actually talk about productively.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking about situations that I've encountered. Maybe you've encountered this too, probably. For somebody who comes, who's, I guess, pretty sick, and they're lying about behaviors that are really dangerous. And I know that it's not, I know that they're not telling me the truth, and not in a personal way, but sort of like it's important to get at what's actually happening, because otherwise I can't help this person. But it's also, we're not yet at the place where we have the foundation to be able to do this in the, in a gentle way. But I don't want to push them out by being too confrontational. Do you understand like the bind I'm talking about?
Absolutely. Yeah. 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 And I think it's well, I think there are a couple of thoughts, at least. I don't think that they're really answers, because we all find ourselves in these kinds of double binds. Mm-hmm. You know, we find ourselves in this situation, you know, in relation to renourishment or refeeding with patients. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very, very important that people, you know, increase their weight quickly. I mean, the prognosis is very much influenced with how, you know, it's very much related to how quickly we can get somebody back up to a healthy weight. But, you know, for people who are not eating, that push can be, you know, quite impinging. It can be even, you know, I think traumatic to go through, say, a treatment like FBT. It can ultimately save the person's life, but it can also be very disorganizing to have to eat when the thing that you're most afraid of is eating. Mm-hmm. So we often find ourselves in these kinds of double binds. And I think that's one answer, you know, from my point of view, is that's why we work as part of a treatment team. Mm-hmm. You know, there are different providers with different specializations. So I'm often in the position of doing, you know, a psychoanalytic or psychodynamic psychotherapy, and I'm working with a nutritionist or a therapist, say, who's doing some variant of FBT, or a nutritionist who's doing, you know, food exposure. So I don't discount in the least those other forms of intervention. I think they're very, very important. But, you know, when you introduce them into a psychodynamic therapy, you know, a more pressure-focused form of intervention, it really does have a profound impact on the transference, counter-transference. And you have to think about that. I'm not saying you don't do it, mm-hmm. but you have to think about, how am I conceptualizing this treatment that I'm doing?
Yeah. I'm thinking about this even more broadly for those of the listeners who are not treatment providers, but they've had almost similar experiences, especially if they know somebody who's struggling with an eating disorder and they're not ready to get the help, or the level of help that they need. And this person is sitting and watching this person suffer. And I mean, something that people ask all the time is like, how can I help this person? What do I say? What can I do to get them to see a therapist, to go to a higher level of care? And it's obviously not a blanket statement, and there is no real answer to it. But I think that this is the same issue that people come across, as confronting this person about what's going on. Like, I know that this is happening, will probably just make the person defensive and sink into their either deception or just close themselves off. And so when it feels really dire to actually make a change, but the thing that would make a change would be pushing them away, you are caught in this double bind. And so, like you said, it is something to think about. And yet we think about it, and now what?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're speaking to our kind of limitations as people. I mean, I remember a very early supervisor would so often say to me, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. That was her way of putting it. She can't see the future. She can't, mm-hmm. you know, omnisciently predict, you know, what the impact of her words or her interventions will be. So, you know, there are mm-hmm. certainly people, when confronted, who, you know, kind of entrench themselves in their defenses and become more inaccessible. But there are often, you know, are also many stories of people that had, you know, say a family intervention around their addiction or their eating disorder or whatever. And that was the thing that got them into a treatment context for the first time. So I don't rule out that as a real possibility. And, you know, often mm-hmm. we try to understand the situation as best we can. We, you know, put some trial balloons out there and see how the person responds to them. And then, you know, we make the best decision we can, knowing that, you know, we're not omniscient.
Yeah. So, I mean, given that we don't know and we can't possibly do everything in the correct way because we don't know if there is such a thing as correct. What are some ways to sort of foster more trust so that eventually this person can come to tell the truth or at least trust in the relationship in order to make them feel more safe?
And are we talking now more about psychotherapy or more about kind of day-to-day relations?
I would say either or, because I'm sure some of it overlaps.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think I'd especially in the psychotherapy situation, but, you know, also to some degree in our day-to-day lives, I'd go back to this idea of the case formulation. So if we have a sense that a person is really anxious about, you know, intrusion. Now, you know, if that's their predominant anxiety, they're likely to experience us as intrusive in some way. But we can play into that more or less, right? I mean, we can, you know, behave in ways that are overtly intrusive or try not. We can, you know, in the psychotherapy, try to speak with them about their anxiety around intrusion. Or, you know, to give another example, let's say a person lies because it's a way of protecting their self-esteem. You know, they lie to present a version of the self to the other that is more attractive and compelling. And, you know, this is intended to kind of elicit the attention of the other person. Maybe they were a child who felt their parent was opaque and inaccessible. So, you know, for a person like that, we're very, you know, attentive to potential feelings of shame and humiliation. When we speak to them, we're very careful to phrase things in a way that's open and non-judgmental or maybe even affirming of them. With the idea that if we can help them modulate that anxiety, they'll have more capacity, hopefully, to speak the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm thinking even without a case formulation, just because, do you get this? Do people ask you, are you psychoanalyzing me in social settings? I think just to sort of put that at rest, you know, in normal social interactions, that in lieu of doing case formulations about our friends, I think that, or maybe just the people that we encounter, not the people that we know very well. I think sort of taking what you're saying and applying it across the board in terms of creating the space that we are in a way that's not judgmental and I guess kind of neutral in how we approach the person. You know, just sort of like making space for them to be who they are and allowing them to realize that we maybe could be a safe person to interact with might be really helpful sort of across the board. Obviously, we're not becoming this person's therapist in a social setting, but I think those are things that people can sort of take this with their friends or their colleagues and just sort of like foster a little bit more safety.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, in day-to-day relations, there's certainly a lot to be said for, you know, kind of spacious, non-judgmental presence. And you know, I agree with you. We certainly don't want to be making, you know, case formulations of our friends. Though, I mean, you know, I think something people do in every day-to-day social interactions is, you know, mentalize other people. Often subconsciously, there's this kind of ongoing work of interpreting other people's behavior in terms of mental states and interpreting our own behavior in terms of mental states. And that's what makes their behavior you know, meaningful. And of course, you know, our mentalization shapes our action.
Yeah. I'm thinking about, you know, going back to thinking about somebody who might be a lot, I guess, for lack of a better way to put it, I don't really love this way of phrasing it, but someone who might be a lot of quote, sicker on the spectrum and how that impacts how we interact with their deception because of potentially their level of motivation. And I wonder if there's like a little bit more there that we can talk about.
Say more about the link you're seeing between
level of motivation. If there's somebody that that will take to us sort of pointing something out, assuming we've laid the foundation, then to me, it feels like they need a little bit of a pull to get out and a forum to talk about their anxieties about what would happen if they didn't lie. There's another way of another type of reaction that I've seen that to me doesn't seem like the person just needs me to extend their hand to talk about it. They seem to want to push me away. Like, I'm not interested in exploring or admitting that I'm lying. And I think the level of motivation or interest in exploring that or at least understanding it or talking about it, to me feels like a lot of the difference in how the conversation goes. Like, is this person interested in not lying?
Well, I think that's a very legitimate question. So, I mean, you know, in the psychotherapeutic context, I mean, if somebody came to me, you know, for consultation with that description, you know, the first question I'd be thinking about is, well, what is the working alliance between you and this patient? Or is there a working alliance? You know, is there a bond? Is there a task? And is there a goal? And in particular, what's the shared understanding of the task and the shared understanding of the goal? What is this person here for? What do they want relief from? And do they understand, you know, what psychotherapy is about? Often the answer is no. You know, when people find themselves in a kind of impasse like that, often the answer is no. And then when it's yes, you know, the second question would be, okay, this person is outwardly expressing that they're not interested in, you know, their deception. They're not interested in being truthful. Well, you know, are there other parts of them that have different opinions that will show up over time? You know, often people have a kind of outward presentation of indifference or commitment to whatever behavior they're engaged in. But maybe, I mean, just maybe there's ambivalence in there. Maybe there's some other part of them that feels differently. You know, we want to give space and take time to see if that part can eventually find a voice.
So you're saying that it's not either someone's motivated or not motivated. There's a level of ambivalences.
I think, you know, in a psychotherapy situation, that's a kind of fundamental assumption, is that there's some degree of conflict. But, you know, practically, that may not always be true. Sometimes people just don't want what we have to offer. And that's totally, you know, that's totally their right.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm thinking about, you know, when we scratch the surface, if say this is the kind of person who initially it sort of almost recoils from this exploration, no, I'm going to protect myself, I'm going to continue to lie. But maybe if we can sort of scratch that surface a little bit, maybe soon they'll come to, yeah, maybe I'm ambivalent about it. So they're a little bit further on a continuum there.
Yeah, I think that can be true. You know, if they really feel that we hear and take in their protest and don't challenge it, and if they really feel that we've heard them, then that may, you know, allow that part of them to relax enough for some other part to speak.
Which I think is really important for us to think about. If we're committed to helping someone explore their deception, then we have to remove our own personal feelings, especially if they're like offended or hurt feelings, from being able to, I mean, this is across the board with really any transference, but if I'm feeling like, I mean, I don't know, in a situation, I guess this would be a little bit different than a psychotherapeutic setting, but if I'm getting offended by someone lying to me, like, how dare you lie to me? I'm trying to help you. It sounds funny as I say this out loud, but like, if that is what's underneath coming into the conversation, then we're not going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
We need to be able to be neutral when we're talking about this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the way I'd put it is that reaction that we're having of being offended or whatever it is information, you know, for us. And you know, we take that as information to kind of deepen our understanding of what's going on. It's not so much something to be kind of acted out in the relationship itself.
Yeah. You make therapists seem like saints.
Well, we don't always succeed, right? And even when we do succeed, we may be, you know, up at 2 a.m., you know, feeling whatever we're feeling.
Yeah. Well, I guess the key here is, in order to have these conversations, they're really delicate. And we have to bring as much neutrality and curiosity to the conversation, even if we're feeling hurt or angry or frustrated. That's just not an appropriate place to put that or act it out. because then we're not actually creating a place for this person to explore.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, I think that's what people have tried to get at with this idea of neutrality. If we don't like that word, you know, we could also just say that our reaction, you know, our aspiration is for our reaction to be highly processed or mentalized before it is, you know, then played out in the therapy relationship in something we say or some comment we make.
Yeah. I have one last question before we wrap up. I think you had alluded to this earlier, but I wanted to circle back to this. We're talking about lying and deception. And again, not, we don't mean this way, but sort of alluding that this is not the best way to interact in terms of healthy trust of relationships. Again, like not pathological, but sort of the attempt or goal is to have someone tell the truth or at least trust that the other person can handle their truth. Is lying ever okay?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's a, you know, question for moral philosophers or something, but I mean,
well, you heard it here first. Tom says it's okay. Yeah. End of conversation.
but well, you know, it seems to me that, you know, morally there are places when it would make sense to lie. I mean, you know, somebody comes running down the street and then a few minutes later, somebody comes chasing them with a gun and they say, which way did that person go? You know, you might want to misdirect them if they don't look like a police officer. Somebody, you know, asks you a question that you know, do I look good in this pair of pants? And you think, maybe not, you know, but you want to find a way to say that. Maybe you don't want to deceive them, but you want to find a way to say it, maybe that shades the truth in the direction of kindness. We're rarely, you know, served by just saying everything in the altered way possible, right? So that seems true to me. And then I think, you know, in psychoanalytic theory, there is embedded a vision of health. And, you know, one aspect of health is surely something in the direction of emotional honesty. And if our patients are struggling to be emotionally honest with us, well, you know, I mean, certainly one thing I'd be thinking about is, you know, maybe you don't need to call it pathological, but I would be thinking of that as problematic for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a really good way of thinking about it. Obviously, this isn't like an ethics class, so people can figure out where their values lie. And of course, you know, across the lying continuum, so say something like a little white lie is very different from a destructive lie. But I think very often people use the word blunt as, I mean, sometimes they mean it in a positive way and sometimes they mean it as a criticism. And I think what you're alluding to is, even if there is truth spoken, there is a way to say it that can be gentle. And we don't necessarily need to rely on lying per se. But, you know, there's a way to think about our relational dynamics and our relationships that actually honors the relationship as opposed to truth versus lies as the priority.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think about children as an example. I mean, you know, children ask questions all the time, you know, think about
why,
you know,
why?
Yeah,
why?
Yeah. Or you know, think about a child in the midst of the coronavirus, you know, mommy, daddy, am I going to die? You know, well, you could say, well, there is a 0.5% chance that you'll die of the coronavirus. Well, that's just going to make a kid terribly anxious. What they need to hear is, you know, no, honey, it's going to be okay. It's a white lie in the service of, you know, care and stability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then that sort of bleeds into what's the question actually about. And answering that question is far more important than answering the surface question. And so
yes,
then maybe the truth versus the lie is questionable at that point.
Yes. Yeah. There's a deeper meaning to the question. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this has been very interesting. Very interesting. thank you so much for doing this again. I really appreciate it. And it's been fun. Before I let you go, where can our listeners find you?
Yeah, my website is www.tomwoldridge.com. And, you know, I don't put a lot there, but my email address is on there if you want to reach out to me.
And is your article published? Like if people want to read it, the one on the lying and deception?
Yeah, there is an article in Psychoanalytic Quarterly. It's called Deception in Anorexia Nervosa. And I can't remember the subtitle, but if you just type that into Google Scholar, it will come up.
Okay. And we can link to some of your other work also in the show notes.
Yeah. Thank you so much.